in Tehran. Chris, cut number 12.
Sometimes you have moments, Stephen. I happen to believe that we can't kick the can down the road any longer in trying to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear bomb. They used the killing of Soleimani as an excuse to say, we're scrapping the Iran deal. We all know they were scrapping it anyway. So what better time than now to say, we're starting the clock. You've got a week. You've got X amount of time before we start taking out your energy production facilities. We take out key infrastructure. We take out your missile sites. We take out nuclear developments.
That is
we
not
take
a
out
popular
port
idea.
Capabilities. Or, you know what, take out a Quds headquarters while you're at it, if you want. I understand that's not a popular idea. If we're going to fight to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear bomb, this regime, then we need to rewrite the rules that are advantageous to us. I don't want to hit cultural sites on purpose, but if you're using one to harbor your most dangerous weapons, then that should be on the target list.
Rewrite the rules so they favor us. Gee, I wonder what Vladimir Putin would do if the United States purported to bomb Tehran, Secretary Hegseth. What do you think, Phil?
Well, I think Vladimir Putin would actually act in terms of his own national interests and might feel that that is a non-productive direction to be going in. I would point out that this Hegseth is crazier even than he just came across as. I've been informed by a good friend who's followed his career rather closely that he is not only rather an extremist Christian in many respects. He's also what was referred to as a third temple person. Now, these are the Christians who basically want to destroy the Muslim Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and replace it with a third Jewish temple. And this, of course, would, in their minds, would lead to the Armageddon. That would lead to the end of the world, and we would all either go up to heaven or somewhere else. So this is how crazy these people are. And to be talking about these people as potential secretaries of defense with all those weapons and all those tools at their fingertips, this is obscene. This is so bad. You know, who could imagine that a guy like this would be considered for Secretary of Defense?
This is Pete Hegseth talking about women in combat. Number 13, Chris.
I think a huge one is women in combat and quotas. I think the way they pushed that under Obama in a way that had nothing, zero to do with efficacy, zero to do with lethality and capability.
You don't like women in combat?
No.
Why not?
I love women service members who contribute amazingly because everything about men and women serving together makes the situation more complicated and complication in combat means casualties are worse.
Is there a basis for that, or is this just his cultural conservatism?
Well, I think there's a certain basis for it in that women, obviously, in certain combat roles have certain physical liabilities like upper body strength and things like that. But to make an across-the-board condemnation of this, I think the experiment of women in many Department of Defense roles has been very positive.
What do you think is the big picture here with Donald Trump appointing these neocons, warmongers and Zionists to these sensitive positions? I don't know if the Rubio thing is going to happen or not, but Stefanik, Huckabee, and Hegseth have formally been announced. What do you think is Trump's game here? Did he materially mislead the American public during the campaign? Did we misread him? Is there something going on here that we don't know about? Is he a secret neocon who really likes war because he likes to kill people like he killed General Soleimani, who was on a peace mission?
Well, he certainly believes he has the license to kill, just as Mr. Netanyahu does. And that's a very dangerous thing. The president does not have a license to kill. But, you know, this is all scary stuff. You know what really scares me is the fact that we are enabling someone who is plausibly insane in the form of Netanyahu to do whatever he needs to get away with his own personal needs, and also for the advancement of Israel as the sole major military power in the Mideast region. And I am very afraid that this clown, this idiot, would use nuclear weapons if he felt it was a good idea on Iran, on Syria, on Lebanon. And we'd get people like these gentlemen that we're just talking about who would endorse it, would say, oh, it's perfectly all right. They were being threatened by an Iran that has the capability of building its own nuclear weapons. We would hear that kind of thing. And that's when my head explodes.
Who will have the upper hand, Trump or Netanyahu? Or stated differently, is there a reason for Netanyahu's bounce in his step? Does he now believe he'll get whatever he wants from the U.S. government under Donald Trump?
Well, he obviously believes that because people are telling him that. And I would suspect that those are the people in the Israel lobby in the United States, and as well as that, people like Miriam Adelson, who gave him $100 million to basically allow her country, Israel, to take over all of historic Palestine. So we have all these kind of influences working on Trump, who admittedly is not a very well-educated or bright man. He's driven by ego. He's driven by compulsions. And this makes him happy to think that he's so loved by all these sorts of people.
He once proclaimed himself, I think you wrote about this in your column at the UNS Review, and this might actually be true, that he's the most popular politician in Israel.
Yeah, he said he could get elected to high office in Israel instantly because he's so popular.
I guess he forgot that he's not Jewish and therefore he's not not eligible for the office.
Well, I did say he's not intelligent.
Thank you, Phil. Always a pleasure. I appreciate you moving your usual time to accommodate my needs. No matter what we talk about, it's a pleasure to hear you and be able to pick your brain. All the best, my dear friend.
Okay, well, have a good debate today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani. He's going to explain the book Islamic Beliefs, Reclaiming the Narrative. This book contains the lectures delivered by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei prior to the Islamic Revolution, and it focuses on revisiting the sacred scripture to better understanding the true purpose of faith, consequently changing the way we see life and the world around us.
So, brothers and sisters, our main topic tonight is about the concept of tarbiyah and the idea of having a plan for the second 7 years. Our plan, brothers and sisters, is going to be made up of 3 points. There'll be 3 major points that we'll be trying to achieve. And if we can choose these 3 points, then inshallah we'll be able to accomplish this task. These 3 points that I want to share with you are something that, one, as a family we would try to initiate and make sure happen. As a school, we want to have a plan for the second 7 years. What are we supposed to do so that our children turn out to be warriors for the Mahdi? And as a community, again, these 3 principles will apply. So, what we're going to do is to talk about the concept of karama or Islamic dignity. What does it mean to feel valued by God? How is a person who enjoys Islamic dignity, Islamic self-worth, different from others? So our first point would be just actually define this. Look at the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. Inshallah, brothers and sisters, when you and I go through something like this, our focus isn't, well, let's focus on getting our children together. They need to hear. No, no. The idea would be, let's first of all find out, are we people of karama? Do we have the traits of those who consider, who have self-respect, who have Islamic dignity? Right? So the first part would be one where we're looking at the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt and trying to see, do any of these apply to us? Are we people of karama? Are we people of dignity? The first thing. But after that, we want to take practical steps. The practical steps involve a plan. So, for us, we're going to first of all define, and this will take a little while, to define what karama is. What are we looking for? What's the objective? What are we hoping that our children after, when they're 14, they'll be like? We have to define that. After that, it's a little bit more than that. Islamic tarbiyah, brothers and sisters, has two dimensions. After we've defined the goal, next, people receive training. Because remember, the title of the speech was this: Valued by God, Establishing Islamic Dignity. How do we still instill a sense of Islamic self-worth? How do we instill it? Islamic tarbiyah, brothers and sisters, involves a two-step process. One of them is going to be observation. If we want our children to be people of karama, we have to find out, what does that mean? What are those traits like? But then secondly, we would need to then model that behavior. It's not just enough that we talk about it or we command people to be like that. We would need to then model that behavior. Children need to observe what people of karama are like. What does it mean if somebody's dignified? How are they different than other people? When I look at them, what do I see? To grow up in that kind of a household. Now, two quick points of order about that. When it comes to learning through observation, what I see, because remember, actions are a lot louder than words. We can all go over hadith of Ahlul Bayt. Can we all act on them? If we want to get the results, we have to act. Now, the thing about acting or observation, our children learning through observation, are two points. Number one is that, brothers and sisters, destructive behavior is easier to teach than constructive behavior. If I want to be, for my children to feel dignified, to feel a sense of self-worth, if I want to model that behavior, is it enough for me? At one time in my life, I behaved in a very dignified fashion. Or is behavior something that's taught gradually, learned gradually? I'm in a household where people are interacting, are modeling the right behavior. They're acting with karama. They're acting as dignified people. But it takes time. Also, as I mentioned, the destructive behavior is a lot more damaging. And it happens a lot faster. So, if I'm not behaving in a dignified fashion, if I'm not behaving as if I've recognized the position that I have with me and Allah, I can quickly send my children down the rabbit's hole. So, after, we'll review the points. The first, after identifying, it would then be to act. And again, it becomes, again, something that we're focusing on, because now it's even increased muraqabah, increased vigilance over ourselves to make sure that I'm behaving in the right way so that my children grow up and they're seeing this kind of right behavior. The third point would be this. Even just modeling correct Islamic behavior wouldn't be enough. It's a three-step plan. I have to know what it is. I have to model that. But even just me living with dignity, interacting with karama, would that be enough? No. The third step is that we have to interact with our children in such a way that they feel worthy in front of the eyes of God. How do I interact with you in such a way that but through my interaction you feel deeply valued? So that because of my interactions, you're like, God cares about me. This is beneath my dignity. A dignified person, a person with self-respect, would never do something like this. So it's the three-step process. Identifying, modeling, and then finally, interacting in such a way that the person can see. Now, if you don't mind, I want to mention something about this too. Sometimes when we are teaching through our actions, right? I'm trying to model such and such behavior, and I'm teaching you by you what you see. Sometimes the intent that I have is not, so by my actions, I'm not trying to convey the wrong message to you. I'm not intending to teach you, for instance, that you're worthless. For instance, that God doesn't, I'm not intending that. But my behavior is such that it still carries that message. So there's something else that we have to keep in mind when it comes to doing tarbiyah in the right way. My behavior, sometimes it carries an unwanted message. I'm never intending that. Doesn't matter. Actions speak louder than words.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati. وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This title given to the 11th Imam, Al-Askari, is because of a military camp.
Al-Kindi, he was a philosopher who lived during the time of Imam Hassan Al-Askari. When he gets there, he finds Imam moving towards a community who are anticipating him.
This is Dialogue, an introduction on the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Hasan ibn Ali al-Askari alayhi salam, the father of the 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, was the 11th Imam of the infallible Imams from the Ahlul Bayt of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. The blessed and pious Imam carried the banner of Islam, undertook the goals of the religion, and sacrificed his life unto this way. He was indeed a fountainhead of knowledge and wisdom. He faced many incredible difficulties and tragedies and hardships in order to spread and promote and keep intact the high values and goals of the religion of Islam. Truly, there are so many countless favors that have been bestowed upon the Muslims by the divinely appointed Imams, the infallible and immaculate Imams, including Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam. Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of the 11th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Hasan ibn Ali al-Askari al-Zaki alayhi salam. What a beautiful Imam to be speaking about. His eminence was truly oppressed during his time, but he was also incredibly powerful. And it is because of his incredible power that he was oppressed and put down. But of course, just as the Holy Quran says that nobody can put out or keep the light of Allah subdued, it will expand over all the universes, whether the enemies like it or not. So we have this very interesting conversation, which is about Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam. Yes, normally we focus on the conversations and the dialogues that occur between the Imam and his companions or his relatives or his friends or sometimes even the enemies in the opposition. But here there are these two individuals who are speaking about Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam. And so one of these individuals is a very famous politician of that time by the name of Ahmad bin Ubaidillah bin Khakan. And so this Agha Ahmad, this Mr. Ahmad, he was talking to another individual, and he was talking about Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam. And he said to the other man, he said, I have neither seen nor known in Surra man Ra'a, which is Samara of present day, a man from the Alawids like Hasan bin Ali bin Muhammad bin Rida alayhi salam, meaning Imam Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam. And he says, nor have I heard the like of his guidance, faith, chastity, nobility, and generosity, neither from among his own family nor from among the rulers. Now, what's interesting is that despite the fact that this man by the name of Ahmad, he is a politician, he's a statesman, but still he says that when it comes to guidance and faith and chastity and nobility and generosity, that he hasn't even seen the rulers of the Abbasid Empire be in and have these certain qualities and characteristics that Imam Hasan ibn Ali al-Askari alayhi salam has. So of course it is one thing for people to praise the Imam when they compare him to himself, meaning, you know, as himself he is a person who's generous, he's a person who's brave, he's a person who is knowledgeable. But when you start to compare the Imam with the great rulers, I mean, clearly, you know, a ruler or an emperor or a caliph or a king and monarch like the Abbasids, who have vast amounts of treasure, they would be very generous and they would be very, you know, altruistic, and they would give a lot of money to people. But despite this, we find that this individual has said that it is Imam Askari alayhi salam who is even more generous than the greatest and most powerful kings of his era. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Askari alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Salim Yusuf Ali.
And I was just conversing with one of the brothers, and he was saying that he found this to be an interesting fact that he didn't know about before, that, you know, we had imams who their entire imama was spread across a very short number of years, and when they were very young. And we have imams, of course, who became younger at an earlier age. But the Imam Askari alayhi salam, you know, fairly young, and then a very short period of imama. But age is not something which, you know, factors in when it comes to, you know, the chosen ones. And these elite among human beings, they were able to give their guidance to human beings. They were able to serve in that role of being imama despite whatever age they were at. And sometimes, you know, we have this notion in our society that, you know, like, okay, we're going to live long, right? So when we're young, we can kind of like mess around and like, you know, make mistakes and, you know, it's all good, right? When we get to be older and more mature and more wiser, right, then we'll settle down and like we'll figure out how things really ought to be done. And of course, you know, there's always room as long as we're alive for asking forgiveness for our sins and for repenting and for going back and, you know, revisiting some of our past decisions and, you know, coming back to the path. That door of repentance is open. But one of the things that we can do when we study the lives of our imams alayhi wasalam is to say that, well, God gave me these examples of these individuals who were so great and so, you know, amazing at a very young age, right? What can I take in terms of inspiration for my decisions and the choices that I'm going to make? So the Imam alayhi wasalam lived during the khilafah of three of the Abbasid khalifas, Mu'taz billah, Muhtadi billah, and Mu'tamid billah. And according to this scholar, Ustad Mahdi Peshwai, he says that each one of them was more harsh than the previous one in terms of their oppression of the Imam alayhi salam. With the first two, Mu'taz and Muhtadi, both of them, they actually lost their power right when they were about to deal the final blow and actually, you know, commit that assassination of the Imam. Meaning that, you know, throughout their period of their khilafah, you know, the one thing that was really troubling them was the presence of Imam Askari alayhi salam.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
hidden files. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, we're very fortunate today to have a very special guest with me here in the studio, Mr. Gilles Duvert from France, international lawyer and very, very influential in what he's doing, especially dealing with the Palestinian situation. So stay with us. We have a very good show for you.
Gilles Duvert is a lawyer, former hospital nurse, and a lecturer and researcher at the Faculty of Law of the University of Lyon 3. For some 30 years, he has been active in health and social sectors and the defense of minorities in France, Palestine, and elsewhere. He's filed a complaint with the International Court of Justice on behalf of groups representing victims of Israeli attacks during the 2008-2009 Gaza War.
Very happy to have you here with me. Can you please tell me about yourself and why did you decide to take the lead at the International Criminal Court to prosecute Israel?
First of all, I would like to tell you the pleasure is all mine, and I'm happy to be here in Tehran, in Iran. And we have been working for a week together with my lawyer friends. And although we may have a lot of differences, we find ourselves on common ground when it comes to the issue of the legal rights of the Palestinians, which is very, very heartwarming and very important. And then there's also the personal aspect of it, if you will, that one does not become a lawyer representing the Palestinian people by chance. An important choice was made by the lawyer, and initially it is a reflection on human rights, on what we know as and what we call human rights. However, almost always the spotlight is on the individual, and that leads to missing the essential issue here, which is the collective aspect of it. So the first step is to highlight and to have a collective defense in order to defend the people in court. So I've worked a lot on this issue, and this time I'm doing it for Palestinians. You should know that I have also done this for other cases. For example, I'm particularly involved in the case of the Western Sahara. I currently represent the Polisario Front, which is a small group of Sahrawi people who are fighting for their independence. Also in France, there are issues pertaining to the colonial era that have not been resolved properly in Guadeloupe, in Mayotte, and in New Caledonia. And there's also the situation of minorities in France. In short, defending people's collective rights is my area of expertise and what interests me the most.
But particularly this case and prosecuting Israel, let's start from here. Are you optimistic because it's never been done before?
I'm an optimist, but not an ordinary optimist who says, oh, the world is so wonderful. On the contrary, I would say that the world is an extremely difficult place to live in. It's incredibly harsh for the Palestinians in particular. So I am optimistic because I can see that today we can reap the rewards of 15 years of legal work on the Palestine issue. And this is the legal work that has been done directly for the Palestinians, and especially the Palestinians in Gaza, those who were easier to contact. So that is how we were able to build many legal cases. And when I see the difficulties we had at the beginning, I have to acknowledge that there were many, many obstacles we had to overcome. The obstacles were lifted little by little. I will elaborate on that later. But when I filed the complaint on November 9th, considering that I had contacted the prosecutor's office maybe 10 in advance, I got an appointment right away. Maybe 10 months in advance, I got an appointment right away. I was able to arrange a meeting at the victim's support office. I was also able to arrange a meeting at the prosecutor's office, and we immediately started working on the substantive questions regarding the case and on the evidence. Because all the accountability issues that you find in the media reports all the time, all of that has been resolved between us. So here we have the Palestinian people and the lawyers. The lawyers make appointments with the prosecutor. We are received, and the investigation begins. All of this leads you to conclude that there is a level of optimism because we have made progress. That's the first thing. And the second is that lawyers are beginning to understand that they have work to do. Not too long ago, everything related to Palestine was managed by NGOs. And without a doubt, NGOs can do great things on a social level and when it comes to delivering aid and also on a communication level. But with all due respect, they're not legal professionals. Everyone should be doing their own job. When you're sick, you go see a doctor. You don't go to a journalist who has written a book on the disease. So when you have a legal problem, go see a lawyer. Trust me, you will be treated very well. So here's what happens. Lawyers know how to carry out legal procedures. It's their job. Things are changing gradually. I initiated it, and now we're spending a lot of time raising awareness on this issue. So when we launched the project, in fact, in only 1 week, we had over 300 signatures. And now we're very satisfied because we've been able to gather around the Palestinian Bar Association and create the largest solidarity movement between lawyers that has ever existed in history. All of this leads you to say that it is not just a symbolic move. It is law working at its best.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Why hasn't this done before? Because we know that the situation with the Palestinians has been going on for 75 years now. So why haven't we seen legal measures taken before in the international community?
I think even the situation in Palestine and the way it's been for the past 57 years has been defined by international law as being under military occupation. However, I personally prefer to base my own analysis on the events that have happened since 1917 and the Balfour Declaration. And the complaint that I filed for the genocide case also reviews the events from 1917. Because in 1917, they said that we were going to create a Jewish national home in Palestine. However, in Palestine, the mayor of Jerusalem can immediately react by saying, but you cannot create a state here because we're already here, we exist. And so, in fact, you have a continuous chain of events from 1917 until now. And indeed, as far as the Palestinians are concerned, the historical background is very important. You may ask why? That is because the Palestinians are not in a position to claim anything in legal terms. If employees ask for something, they claim it. If people want more freedom, they claim it. But Palestinians are not claiming anything. They're simply saying, we have rights that must be respected. We have the right to live on our land. We are the Palestinian people. There is a Palestinian land. I'm not claiming it, but instead I'm simply asking for my rights to be respected. Well, for a very long time, there were no legal actions, but now there are two things I have to point out. First, from the 1970s, there was the Great Palestinian Movement based on armed resistance, which combined resistance and legal discourse. And this was very effective because the Palestinian people, who were completely eliminated from the UN, returned to the UN while their right to sovereignty and their right to self-determination was also recognized. And the Palestinian National Authority was recognized as a sovereign movement representing the people. So that was great progress, but the law had been used as an argument to put forth links with the resistance. And just as we reach this result, there is obviously the United States, which, as we know, is always there to stop the movement in order to protect Israel, who is there to control this part of the Middle East and divide the territory. So they saw the catastrophe coming, and the catastrophe was the fact that after all the mess that was created, Palestine was going to become a state. It was going to be recognized again as a state. And so they put pressure on them to negotiate for peace, pushing for the Oslo Accords to be signed. I spare you the details. What eventually happened was that they said, okay, so you're here for peace, therefore you have to negotiate, of course. So then you begin to negotiate within the framework of the Oslo Accords. And that is how they managed to sell this to the Palestinians. The Oslo Accords were a very big regression. Why? Because the people who had managed to become the subject of international law lost this position. And they became dependent on the Israeli side, as if it was the Israeli side that had all the rights and could transfer it to them. This is how the Palestinian Authority was created, and how it was detached from international law, and therefore was not likely to go to court. Because if they ever said, "We're acting on behalf of the Palestinian Authority from a legal aspect," the response would be, "Well, the Palestinian Authority gets its existence from the Oslo Accords, so you can't invoke a treaty. You cannot take your case to court." So first, this process has to be eliminated with everything the Palestinians believe in, considering the fact that the Oslo Accords were simply encouraging colonization. And now, the most important thing for me about the recent developments is to see Palestinians pulling out of the Oslo Accords. In other words, to see the end of the Oslo Accords. And finally, for this to be the excellent news, the Palestinian people are once again recognized by international law. They can sign treaties, they can be represented in court, and they can find sister states like South Africa, for example, who will do what it did to start a legal procedure, which creates the opportunity for them to appear before the judges and to hire lawyers to defend them. The Oslo Accords were a legal disaster. And we're coming out of it with the return of Palestinian people in the sphere of international law. Now, the second point I would like to raise very quickly is that these international proceedings, as we will see very soon, are too complicated. They're not very satisfactory. A lot of things about them will have to change. But the important issue is that they exist. So we're seeking to improve them, to strengthen them, like a child that is growing up, rather than repeating what propaganda wants us to, that we should eliminate them altogether because they're no good, simply because they want a world without justice. But everyone can draw parallels with what happened in Sabra and Shatila. Sabra and Shatila was a massacre. Maybe not a genocide, because the scale of the victims was not that much, but it was a massacre. And it was, at the very least, a crime against humanity. However, there were no legal proceedings. Why? Because there were no international courts. Now we have the courts. We can improve them. We can demand judges be more available. That is the truth. There are courts that exist, and the people of Palestine now have the benefit of having access to an international court, say the ICC. They can hire lawyers to represent them in court, and they can also give us mandates. You, as a Palestinian, give me a mandate, you sign it, and the next day I see a prosecutor and I say, "I'm here to defend a Palestinian."
Can you explain the difference between the International Court of Justice, ICC, and the International Criminal Court, ICC?
You're absolutely right, because there can be confusion. It's not all very simple. The oldest international court is the ICJ, which stands for the International Court of Justice. It dates back to the establishment of the UN in 1945, and it is the UN-based international court. So it has authority over all the states that are registered in the UN General Assembly. But this court has jurisdiction only over the states. That is to say, for example, we have criticized the court for not ruling to demand a ceasefire with the war against Hamas, which is in fact one of the two parties. But the truth is, it could not have demanded a ceasefire because the armed resistance is not a state. This court, the ICJ, can only address states. However, it is the most important of all international courts. And when we look at the rulings, very often we see that the party that has lost says, "But this ruling is political." But then, afterwards, they abide by the ruling because they cannot do otherwise. And the best example is the case of Nicaragua against the United States, where we have the small communist state of Nicaragua against a very powerful U.S. that rules the world. But Nicaragua had strong arguments. It presented them to the court, and the judge condemned the United States. And when the ruling was announced to the U.S., they said, "There must be a mistake. The judge doesn't understand anything." And then finally, a few months later, they abided by the court ruling because a state cannot retain its international status by saying, I don't care what the International Court of Justice says. You see, that is impossible, because it is the court of the UN. So in the end, you simply have to abide by its ruling. And if the Israeli side does what it wants, like a criminal on the run, that's when its allies start to say, no, you can't keep on doing this. We're witnessing this happening right now. The ICC, however, is different. First of all, it is much more recent, dates back to 2002, so the court is actually only 20 years of history and experience. Now, this court accepts cases against people, not against states. So I filed a complaint and I requested an arrest warrant for Mr. Netanyahu, for the Israeli Minister of Defense, and for the Israeli head of state. I did not file a complaint against which and which state. So the ICC is a criminal court for people. So in fact, for example, if you commit a crime and you stand trial before the court and the prosecutor, you just might end up in prison. So not all the states recognize the ICC. Its recognition is voluntary. However, for the International Court of Justice, as long as you are a member of the UN, you are automatically under the control of the International Court of Justice. This is not the case with the ICC. Recognizing the ICC is voluntary because it's independent from the UN. Currently, there are 125 states that have accepted its jurisdiction, including the state of Palestine. And according to the rules and regulations, the court has jurisdiction from the moment that an element of a crime or a part of a crime is committed on the territory. So considering the fact that the state of Palestine has ratified the treaty and recognizes the court, the crimes committed on this territory fall under the jurisdiction of the court, no matter who commits the crime. The court does not care whether or not the defendant comes from a country that recognizes it, and the defendant can be arrested anywhere in the world.
Do you think that these courts, because of course there are people right now that are thinking that these courts have been politicized, that there are political elements that help control it. Do you think that, for example, if we're talking about the ICJ or the ICC, that there can be a fair hearing in looking at, for example, the Israeli regime?
I am in a place where I can confirm that the U.S. has a lot of influence in these international courts, particularly from the so-called Western clan. Because for the past 15 years, for example, I have seen all the obstacles put on my way. So I've lived the experience. But I can also see that despite all that, we are making progress. And so I must send this message once again, that I am not a happy-go-lucky optimist. This is an optimism that comes from achieving results. You should see the huge difference. When you are debating a case at the UN Security Council, say with Algeria's initiative, demanding a simple thing, as simple as a humanitarian ceasefire, something that's been discussed for a week prior to that through diplomatic means, you come to the actual session and Algeria presents its proposal for a humanitarian ceasefire and allowing humanitarian trucks to cross the border and bring food and medical supplies, the U.S. vetoes, and it's over. This is the reality of the political world we live in today. But when we go down the legal route, there is no veto from the United States. When the U.S. appears in the International Court of Justice, it has half an hour to make its case, just like Cuba. It has half an hour just like Comoros. It has half an hour just like Palestine. And there is no veto. And when we are at the International Court of Justice, they do have influence in the corridors. They have enough influence to try and pressure us. But they do not have direct influence in court, and so we continue. So I call for working on the legal aspect of the matter. Of course, there is a lot of work to be done because it is complicated. They create lots of obstacles for us. But we manage to make progress despite all that, and in the end, what do we see? We see that the judges are now actively involved. You know, the judges are required to have the same approach in applying the rules no matter where they are in the world. Let me explain. We are all well aware of this fundamental problem that exists, which we call double standards. The fact that I cry when something happens to someone and neglect it when it happens to someone else. Or, for example, I get really angry when someone does something and then approve of it when someone else does the same thing. We're all very familiar with this situation. But for a judge, this is impossible. And so, as more and more cases are referred to the court, the judge cannot rule differently. For example, because it is the case of Palestine, or it is the case of Libya or Crimea. As a judge, I'm required to adhere to the same ruling in similar cases. This is what makes it interesting. Whenever we file a complaint with the ICC or the ICJ, what we do as lawyers is to study the history of the court. By that, I mean they study similar cases that have been closed. We base our arguments on those cases by referring the court to its own previous rulings. So, for example, we can tell them in such and such case, this is what you ruled. So for the case of Palestine, you have to do the same. So for example, for the definition of genocide, we found 14 rulings from different international courts clarifying what it is. So since it has been seen defined by the court, we can build our case based on that. This is why our arguments are so strong.
We see the recent case filed, or petition filed in the International Court of Justice by South Africa. Let's talk about that. What exactly has happened with that? And tell me your perspective of how significant this is, the filing by South Africa.
On est d'accord, c'est un processus qui se construit.
Well, we should agree that this is a work in progress. The first step was the complaint that we filed as lawyers on November 9th. And as lawyers, we know what we can do in court. And we also know that they might limit what we can do because we do not represent a state and we're not political leaders. That is why we immediately sought to amplify our legal action by saying, we have shown you the way, but there are things which is up to the states to do. Lawyers clearly do not dominate the world. I would be an ordinary romantic with a suggestive view of reality if I were to think otherwise. On the contrary, I'm very, very pragmatic, and I know that we can raise a legal debate, but the states are definitely stronger than us. So we did all the work and even made it public, and then South Africa stepped in twice on two different occasions. Once at the beginning of December, South Africa filed a complaint with the International Criminal Court, the ICC. And South Africa did this with four other states that I want to mention because they are great supporters. There is Bangladesh, there is Djibouti, there is the Comoros, and there is Bolivia, all led by South Africa. So this matters because at the beginning, there was just a complaint made by lawyers on behalf of activist associations. And now there are five states also on board. At the same time, this shows the political weakness on the side of Palestine in terms of the number of states that supported because there are 125 states that recognize the ICC and there are only five who support the procedure. So if you think that the prosecutors could do more, you're right. But member states of the court also could do more, because many of them say that they support Palestine, but when it comes to actions, well, there's nothing. In the meantime, it is clear that our legal procedure is supported by five states. If this increases to six or seven, we will be even more grateful. But for the time being, this is not the case. Then South Africa took the legal proceedings to the next level by citing the Genocide Convention. This is a convention on the prevention and suppression of genocide. First of all, the prevention part is interesting because there is a genocide taking place and this means that there are things we can do about it. And the second interesting thing is that Israel has ratified very few treaties, given that it doesn't want to get its hands tight, just like the United States. However, they have ratified the Geneva Convention and they have accepted the jurisdiction of the court. So, there was a text and there was a jurisdiction. And that's very rare because in many other cases, they have not ratified international treaties and we can't pursue the matter in court.
So South Africa made a clever move by saying that they were going to use the Genocide Prevention Convention, considering the fact that the Israeli side has accepted the jurisdiction of the court to conduct such proceedings. So now we have a legal procedure on the basis of a convention which has not clearly defined what genocide is, and its interpretation will take a lot of time. In fact, the convention is quite brief, and there is a need to define genocide, and the states do not share a single opinion regarding that. But we have not reached a point where that would matter just yet. At the moment, we are in the urgent phase of taking preventive measures. So if you are a judge, say for example, a judge in Tehran, and we tell you that there is a building that might collapse, you may not know if it's going to collapse, but you will definitely take urgent action and demand people evacuate the building, because you have to protect them. You will later decide what should be done about the building. So it's the same thing here, and that is the challenging part. But given that there's still a high probability that a genocide is happening, we need to take measures to protect the people accordingly. There is the mechanics of the legal procedures and how it works. And the court reacted very well to this approach by South Africa. Given that South Africa filed its request on December 29th, the hearing was scheduled on January 11th, and after much deliberation, the ruling was issued on January 26th. It didn't even take a month. 4 weeks was enough to file the complaint, schedule the hearing, and issue a ruling, which, by the way, came in 30 pages in French and English and was enforceable. So the court acted very well with regards to this procedure. What are they saying exactly? Well, the court tells all states, of course, by addressing Israel first and then all the states in the world, since it pertains to the UN, pay attention. There is a genocide going on, and necessary measures must be taken to protect the population. So the measures are aimed first at the Israeli side, that's for sure, but it also addresses all UN member states, and in particular, the supporters and allies of Israel by saying, you have to stop this now, otherwise you are going to move into the genocide camp. Ever since the following day are saying, well, yes, or I don't think so, etc. Yesterday, again in France, a political leader said, I don't think so. But who is this person? Can he replace the judges? No. He's just an insignificant politician, that's all. So the court said, there is a genocide. We must protect the people. And the states now have to distance themselves from this crime. Their statements were weak. They wanted to show that they were not giving up. But we do know that, suddenly, they are asking Israel to act differently. And now that the deadlines are moving forward, they will begin to realize that they are going to be prosecuted for complicity. And this is exactly what Nicaragua has just done. Nicaragua acted just like South Africa with respect to Israel and also Germany, because Germany is the second largest provider of weapons to Israel. Germany has accepted the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. So there is an excellent case now filed by Nicaragua. Now, Germany risks being prosecuted for being complicit in the genocide. So we can see that these days, German leaders are saying, no, but we abide by the standards. We're no longer going to export this and that. So the legal proceedings are working.
Well, Mr. Gilles Dauvert, thank you so much. It has been a pleasure having you on Hidden Files, and all our best with what you're trying to do.
Thank you. Merci beaucoup.
And thank you for staying with us on another Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and a very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic